Welcome to Intelligent Edge Yoga, yoga conversations for smart, compassionate practice with Catherine Ann Flynn. I'm Catherine. Hello, yogis. I hope that you are doing so well, and I'm pleased to bring you my first solo episode for a little while. But I thought, since we are approaching the holiday season, why not talk about disagreeing yogically? Since, depending on your relationships with your family and some of the social circles that you move in, the holidays are a great time for flexing some of our mindful disagreeing skills. Now, I would probably prefer to phrase that as mindful conversational skills, but conversation that flows well and is easeful and genuinely compassionate. Well, I guess we could always hone our skillfulness at that, but it does not cause us the same stress. The stakes are not high, so it's not something that we necessarily feel like we need to hone our skills on. I think more of us have the need to navigate conversations where the stakes are higher and tempers flare, heat rises, etc. So today I'm going to talk about conversations that include disagreement generally for us as yoga practitioners. And then after we do that, I'm going to talk specifically about disagreement among yoga teachers. So if you're not a yoga teacher, know that I'm going to speak to you and generally to all of us as practitioners first. As yogis within the yoga system, we agree to question our perception, as perception is frequently based on experience and preference. When I was pregnant and when I was a new mom, people would frequently say things that rubbed me the wrong way, just didn't sit well, because they had their experience and I had mine. And while there's a little bit of distance now, and I'd like to hope that I navigated it all gracefully, my big takeaway was, wow, if I couldn't understand how this experience would be, and if I feel like other people don't understand what this experience is like, how much do I not understand about other people's experiences? It was another reminder that experience should be honored. Absolutely, we should be able to talk about things. We should be able to proceed with curiosity and compassion. But the curiosity is a key piece, because this is the fool's dilemma. We don't know what we don't know. So when we go into conversation, we have to understand, do I have preference? Do I have experience that makes me feel like I have insight here that other people do not have? And I think that that's sometimes worth saying. I believe, I'm raising my hand here. You can't see, but I'm raising my hand. I have experience that gives me these feelings, that generates this insight. And reminding people that we have different experiences can be helpful. Perception is also important. We understand that the scope of our experiences shapes our preferences and our general frame of reference, how we see things, how we interpret things. Asking questions is a wonderful way to understand what we don't understand. Good lines of questioning should be conversation specific, but some general ones off the top of my head would include, have you always felt this way? What influences these strong feelings? You're clearly very passionate on this topic. Do you know anyone else who feels this way? What is it about this particular topic that speaks to you? Learning how to be good at questions is really an excellent conversation trait, whether it's an easy or a difficult conversation. But we can also ask ourselves questions when diving into these conversations. A key one being, what is it that other people get out of their position that I don't appreciate or that I can't understand. So a common disagreement in the radio sphere right now is regarding the song Baby It's Cold Outside. And a few of the radio stations in Canada have decided not to play this song anymore because of some of the lyric. And they were analyzing this on the CBC, and one cultural commentator said that her interpretation, and one of the interpretations out there, is that the woman's line where she says things like, "Hey, what's in this drink?" refer to the era when people would frequently say things like, "The drink made me do it." But also, it wasn't necessarily acceptable for women to assert that they were interested in sex, that they had to play coy, and it was unacceptable to stay overnight at a man's house unless you were, of course, married and it was your house. So she agreed with this historical contextualization. And that's how I would imagine some older generations would hear it. But contemporarily, we hear, "Hey, what's in this drink?" And we think of references to Rohypnol, more commonly known as the date rape drug. And it's unsettling. We literally hear the song differently. It sits differently for us. Now, if you're getting into a conversation about this particular song and wading into, well, you could always listen to it on your iPod, or you could always change the radio station. If you're starting to wade into this territory, I think it's often useful to just call a spade and say, this conversation is getting heated. We have so many other things to catch up on. I would love to hear about fill in the blank, and then move forward. When we were pregnant, my father-in-law was expressing some uncertainty about the safety of delivering the baby with a midwife. And I calmly looked and smiled at him from across the table and said, "You know, I'm about to get angry at you." And he said, "Oh, no, no, no. Well, if you've done your research," and then he immediately backed down. But this is a smart, opinionated man. And fortunately, someone who heard me when I said that it was not a conversation I wanted to have. Similarly, when other people close to me were not so certain about the validity of a midwife as a primary care practitioner and birth center births, etc., proximity matters in terms of perception. Sometimes we're too close to something. Sometimes we haven't had enough exposure. And so anyone who had concerns, I said, "You know what? Why don't we go meet her? Why don't you come meet her? Come for an appointment. Let's go for a tour of the birth center," right? The closer people get to something, the better and easier it becomes for them to understand it. Of course, there has to be a willingness to understand something. In the Bhagavad Gita, the song of the Lord, the text drawn out of the Hindu epic, the Mahabharata, from which a lot of yogic wisdom derives, it's essentially a conversation between a prince who is trying to go to war with his own family, being guided by his mentor, who in this story is called Krishna, and Krishna is an avatar of the god Vishnu. And Krishna says to Arjuna, the prince, not to share his teachings with anyone unless they are devoted to Krishna and have good obedience to Krishna. Now, when I teach the Gita and I talk about it for modern yogis, Krishna is an embodiment of Vishnu. Vishnu is the sustainer. And what sustains? Love sustains. So I say to those who are not so certain as to how to read this text when it's so devoted to this particular deity, to substitute Krishna for love. So if we reread that passage, it becomes, do not engage in these teachings with anyone who does not have good obedience to love. Now, historically, this could have been because of rigorous secrecy around spiritual texts and their dissemination to the wrong people, and I'm air quoting here. But we can also read this as the preconditions for conversation. If someone is not willing to engage in inquiry in a way that is compassionate and ultimately has the outcome or the desired intention of communion, not necessarily agreement, but communion, then it's not a conversation that probably can be had. Now, I'm not one of those yogis who says that we should never be angry and we should push anger away. In fact, I love the Pema Chodron. She's a Buddhist, but, you know, similar camps. I love the Pema Chodron quotation and frequently share it at the end of my classes about difficult feelings being excellent teachers, because whether it's anger, fear, jealousy, greed, etc., these feelings, rather than leaning out of them, we should learn to perk up and lean into them because they teach us where we are holding back. Anger is incredibly motivating, right? Anger is our fire. Fire is the transforming element. I know people who do incredible work in the world because they are so aghast at the things that humanity is capable of. So that's maybe a mantra that we want to hold dear to our hearts. People are capable of incredible cruelty and incredible kindness. People are capable of incredible destruction and incredible connection and healing. That heat, though, that can really burn us to the ground before we even get going. One of the effects of anxiety and nervousness is the stimulation of the sympathetic nervous system. So you might be familiar with this for the term fight, flight, or freeze. And so when something happens, so for example, the one I always use because I remember so clearly, a car trying to pull into my car from another lane because they didn't check appropriately. So when this happens, our response to a perceived threat is to fight. So, you know, put up the gloves. Flight, run away, or freeze. We're immobilized by our fear. Physiologically, what happens when this is going on is we get higher blood sugar, because higher blood sugar gives our muscles more fuel before they run out and have to start burning, literally burning that sensation. We get a higher heart rate, but it also gives us this kind of tunnel vision. Right? It gives us this ability to singularly focus because perceived threats need to be resolved. And I think that those of you with fire, or maybe fire in higher doses in your constitution, you know, when you get into it, it can be hard to get out of it because you need to make this person understand how incredibly wrong they are. So when the stakes feel high, we are reactive with a narrowed focus. This is not the right setting for nuance and sensitivity. And that's really what our yoga practice should do. It should make us more sensitive, and it should be a process of refinement so that our skillfulness takes a bigger picture frame of reference. When I was doing a little bit of reading on the nervous system, I came across an update to the whole fight, flight, freeze concept. And that developed from Dr. Shelley Taylor, a psychology professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, when she asked herself, is there the possibility that men and women experience this stress response differently? Dr. Taylor decided to look at and conduct some studies because many studies on the stress response did not include women. And so with the intriguing possibility that females of other species often form tight, stable alliances, and they have strong senses of community and seek out friends in times of stress, they, of course, wondered if this was applicable to humans as well. And from their research, it quickly became clear that compared to men, women's physical aggression and fear-related behaviors are less intense and more cerebral. They are displayed in response to specific circumstances and are less tied to physiological arousal. So while both sexes share the capacity for fight or flight, women seem to use it less. And so the idea here is that through different hormones playing out, women have a tendency to tend and befriend. And so that's to smooth things over and create alliances rather than creating separation. If you're a parent, you might recognize this as getting into a bad conversation with a family member and then all of a sudden turning and going, "Oh, look at the cute child we're both invested in. Let's all focus on the cute child and tell inane stories about the cute things that he did this week." That's a real thing. On a neurotransmitter hormonal level, we understand that some of this response is due to endogenous opioids, our own pacifying internal barometers, and oxytocin. And we know that oxytocin is enhanced in the presence of estrogen. So, more research to do for all of us. From the Ayurvedic lens, different people are differently sensitive to these reactions. So people with a lot of air and space to them, lots of Vata people, they are prone toward fear and anxiety. And people with a lot of fire and water to them, our Pitta people, are obviously more prone to fire. And the Ayurvedic system says, like generates like, opposite creates balance. So if you get a fiery person and a fiery person together, they're going to stoke the fire. And alcohol is fiery. From the Ayurvedic lens, it is fire-inducing. And while I will say that obviously if you're a fiery person, you should proceed with particular caution, we all have each of the five elements to our constitution. So regardless of your particular dosha, your particular elemental makeup, you have fire, you consume fiery substances, that fire is going to get stoked. So this holiday season and forever for the rest of time, proceed with moderation and live more equanimously. Back to not knowing what we don't know about other people. We don't know about other people, and their life experiences can shape how they respond to things. A friend told me recently about something really hurtful that a student said to her. It was, this person was hurt by something that this teacher had said in class. She felt it was innocuous, but this person was upset by it and then said hurtful things to this teacher. And when I listened, I agreed that that was upsetting. And then I said that hurt people hurt people. Trauma and poverty make people much more sensitive to reactivity. And we don't know what's in people's past. So while I understand that there are certain things that are said that we just feel we can't allow to pass, and I understand, if it can be allowed to pass and we can reroute, then let's reroute, because again, we don't know what we don't know. Now, for those of us who are trying to navigate these conversations mindfully, we can draw on something called biofeedback, which is feedback from our physiological responses that indicate whether we are having a stress response or not. Biofeedback has been shown to be an incredibly effective way to understand how our behavior increases or decreases these stress responses. People can be hooked up to blood pressure monitors, and they can quickly lower their blood pressure by lowering their voice and speaking more slowly and breathing consciously. People do understand quite easily, quite intuitively, what will produce a calm conversation. Now again, yoga should hopefully cultivate an increased sense of nuance and deeper levels of understanding of ourselves. In Sanskrit, we call this svadhyaya or self-study. And it improves our ability to have our own biofeedback without machines. I have long maintained that any practice that increases your sensitivity to how you feel anxiety in your body can help you in other moments outside your meditation cushion, off your yoga mat. For example, if you know a situation is going to cause you some anxiety, like visiting the bank, even if it's an innocuous bank visit, looking at our finances can cause us anxiety. So when you're in those moments, pay attention to how you feel in your body. Can you sense your heart rate increasing? Can you sense tension moving into places that you do not experience tension when you are relaxed? You know how anxiety feels in your body. And then in other moments, in other situations, if you grow familiar with these feelings, you'll realize, my goodness, I am experiencing anxiety right now. What is causing me anxiety? Do I need to remove the cause? Or can I sit with it and draw on the techniques that I've developed to be here more calmly? What is the best technique we have for developing calm? That's diaphragmatic breathing, friends. Diaphragmatic breathing, the long pranayama, dirgha pranayama, long, round, conscious breathing is the fastest, simplest way to calm the nervous system, which is why a breath-centric practice, no matter what other kind of asana you are doing, if your goal is stress relief, then you're doing the yoga. Now I'm going to slowly switch gears into talking about disagreements among yogis specifically. Last week, I was talking about the ego in several of my classes. Now, being critical of the ego is such a popular thing for a yoga teacher to do that I feel it should almost go on a t-shirt. It's your ego. And we use it a lot in yoga classes and yoga asana classes because we so strongly experience our egos in those classes. But from Sankhya yoga philosophy, your ego is actually a step on your journey to manifestation in prakriti, nature, the material realm, prakriti. It is a required step in your manifestation. If you were completely ego-less, it would look like a psychotic break unless you are enlightened. But your ego is tethered to your senses, and how you manage your senses dictates how you manage your ego, which is one of the many reasons that closing your eyes during yoga classes is so helpful. Because if you're having real egoic drives during practice, we continue to cultivate those strong associations of I, me, mine, because I declared it so. We get confused with that fundamental lie of nature, which is that we are separate. And so when we close our eyes, it carries us inward. And we get that beautiful experience that so many of us are looking for, which is that by spending more time with ourself, we spend more time in our highest self and find it easier to be with other people in community. One of my students' homework recently said that yoga gives her the peace that nature gives. And that since cultivating her yoga practice, she has found herself needing to be in nature more often. And I thought that was such a cool thing to say, because again, it's that refinement of nuance. It's that understanding of the spaces that are sukha, the sweet spaces that are supportive to your spiritual evolution, to your mental and physical wellness, versus the spaces that are not. So as yogis, it's our job to manage our senses, which mediate our interactions with the world and dictate whether we are acting from the lower portions of our mind that have these really strong attachments to I, me, mind stories, or our higher selves, which can recognize our cosmic unity. Now, if you're a yoga teacher, it depends on how long you've been teaching yoga and the kind of network that you have, but chances are you've had a disagreement with someone. It could be because you two disagree over method. This method's the way, your method's crap and bad for the knees. Or it could be about the administration and the operations of yoga. I want to get paid this much, you don't want to pay me that much. But I can tell you that that never goes away. Yogis lie, cheat, steal, act unkindly. They do all the things. Maybe it doesn't make them yogis, but that's a whole other conversation. But what I'm saying is that yogis are people, and these are all things that people do. So we need to calm down the expectation that once someone announces themselves as a yogi, that they are flawless, cloud-floating people. And we need to calm that expectation down because, as Brené Brown says, shame and guilt need secrecy to thrive. And I know a lot of really wonderful yogis who have, you know, stuff that they are working on, and I know they're working on it, but they are so shameful around their stuff that they just choose not to engage. They have these public personas that are problem-free, super nice, non-opinionated, but behind the scenes, they are sometimes difficult and very opinionated and sometimes unkind. On the flip side, there are people who are generating marketing by being overtly opinionated and overtly critical of other yogis. Now, you may remember that in the Yoga Voice episode of the podcast, I talked about how people who are negative in their critiques of other people's work tend to be viewed as more intelligent. This is really problematic for the yoga world because while we are all yogis, we're also all selling something. We're having to figure out ways to differentiate ourselves and say, spend time with me, when there are so many things that you could be spending your time and money on in the general wider world, but also in the yoga world. It's hard to differentiate yourself and very tempting to say, can you believe this person does it this way? And here's how I do it, and it is superior. Now, something that's important to note here is the difference between behaviors and conversation and methods and content. I think it's totally reasonable to have conversations about, here are the limits of your content. Here is what happens, I think. Here's what transpires. Here is my understanding of its limits. Here's what I do. It is useful for, and maybe also acknowledge its limits. I have to do that all the time. I teach functional movement-informed accessible yoga sequences. And people often say to me, well, what about people who want tricky transitions? And then I have to say, there's lots of good teachers out there who teach tricky transitions. I'm more than happy to point people in their direction. There's no way we can possibly be everything to everyone. But marketing and the need to make a living puts pressure on us to figure out how to tell people we can be everything to everyone. Now I'm going to dive into some specifics for a few minutes. If you are in the yoga world, you've likely heard a lot of conversation around the Ashtanga yoga system and its founder, Sri Pattabhi Joyce. Now, for those of you who are less familiar, the Ashtanga yoga system is massively influential in yoga's arrival in North America and yoga's current mode of practice. There are tons of ways to do sun salutations, but the way that you're familiar with sun salutations, courtesy of Ashtanga yoga. Vinyasa yoga branches off of Ashtanga yoga because some people were like, I want to do things differently, because the Ashtanga yoga system is a set series. You do the same thing every time, and there are multiple series. Now, Sri Pattabhi Joyce was one of two students of Krishnamacharya. And I talk about Krishnamacharya in my 300-hour yoga teacher training package, because in the module for growing your teaching practice, i.e., ethics of teaching and the business of yoga, I talk about how Krishnamacharya had known and learned contemporaries, but one of them, Hariharananda Aranya, spent the last 21 years of his life locked in an artificial cave built at his temple, studying and writing philosophical treatises. You could argue that Krishnamacharya was the better marketer, and who does history remember? I'm thinking about this for some of my goals for the new year. I need to sometimes pick up my head from the books and say to people, come do this thing with me. My hands are in the air again, just so you know. Anyway, Sri Pattabhi Joyce was Krishnamacharya's student, and he formed and established this school in Mysore, India. And if you want to be an Ashtanga teacher, you have to go to Mysore to train. And if you are trained in a yoga training at a studio that's an Ashtanga studio, you are not technically an Ashtanga teacher. You have to go to Mysore. Really, it's the original excellent business plan. Some people would call this lineage. I would call this excellent business plan as well. Now, Ashtanga has been in conversation in yoga circles because Sri Pattabhi Joyce, it turns out, abused, harassed, and assaulted many, many women. And if you want to hear more about this, off the show notes on the website at intelligentedge.yoga, I've linked to another podcast with Jay Brown, who interviews Karen Rain. And Karen Rain was one of Sri Pattabhi Joyce's students. And she's in this famous primary series video where there's also Richard Freeman, who's probably the most famous Ashtangi these days. And she, you know, supposedly could have been a famous yoga teacher, but she was so traumatized by what Sri Pattabhi Joyce did to her that she had to leave the school and was unable to keep teaching. It is an excellent interview, particularly if you are interested and disturbed by the Me Too conversations happening in the yoga community. And one of the things she says in the interview that's just so astute is that some people defend Sri Pattabhi Joyce by saying, well, he did some of the same adjustments to men as well. And she said, that's so crazy to think that that makes it acceptable. And goes on to say that teaching students that bodily autonomy is their right and something that we need to remind people is their right is essential to the yoga teacher-student dynamic. Now, I wanted to cover that, but this is not what this particular episode is about. So that's one component of the conversation happening in Ashtanga. There's also a lot of conversations as people's yoga practices have matured in the West. Ashtanga really was, it was in so many ways, the main practice. And there are a lot of people who did it for years and hurt themselves. I did a very Ashtanga-influenced practice in my early years. And actually, out of interest, I went back on my mat to do the primary series recently. And for a period of time, I was enjoying the familiarity that my body found to the rhythm and the pacing and the postures. But then about 30 minutes into the sequence, I realized, oh, this is why my body does not like these particular postures. And for me, that's where set series failed, was that there were no options to say, and today I'm going to look at doing other content because I understand that my body is responding in ways that are injurious. Now, that's a little bit about Ashtanga yoga. Now to the disagreeing. There's a lot of disagreeing going on, but recently some came up in my feed because of two yogis, one I've met in passing, one I haven't met before, but I'm connected on social media to both of them. And one posted a photo of themselves doing a very advanced adjustment on a student and married it to the quotation of getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. And we all understand that this is a very common refrain in the yoga world. How can you get comfortable with things that make you uncomfortable? Though I think we always need to diversify it, because for some of us, that's getting comfortable with finances that make us uncomfortable, or with being calm, kind, and open, because that's uncomfortable for us, or asking for what we need because that's uncomfortable for us, right? This is not just a phrase that should be trotted out in yoga asana, but it is frequently. And now it is rightly critiqued for being encouraging of moving toward extreme ranges of movement that harm more than heal. So the quotation was married to the image, and the addition of the two together create a particular effect, right? We take two texts or images, we put them together, and we see what they say about one another. I think it would be received differently if it was a different image, or if there were more accompanying conversation with the quotation. This is one of the beautiful things about continuing yoga education, is that as the practitioners in the room are more educated, more experienced, they are typically more willing to put up their hand and say, I disagree with you, or what about this perspective? And most presenters and teachers that I respect are always willing to say, of course, that's an excellent angle. I'm speaking about these particular parameters, but that's a wonderful note. Could you expand on it, or we should include it, or if you're looking for another resource on it? But this is the challenge against the guru style of teachings, which is, you might remember that Yoganand, in the previous episode with Yoganand Michael Carroll, he talked about how in India it was just so unheard of for a guru to be questioned, because the guru was seen to be an enlightened being, and so enlightened beings supposedly couldn't get anything wrong. But I think this is a fundamental misunderstanding of the enlightened state. If you were incapable of being wrong, then accompanying enlightenment would be incredible math abilities. Enlightened beings can still get things wrong, and they still have flaws, and they still have neuroses. Think of all the popularly enlightened beings that we know, and think of how many people don't perceive their actions to be accurate and good. If you were hoping that being enlightened meant that you got to be universally adored and won every argument because no one disagreed with you, that's a real bummer. So back to this image. Another teacher took the image and then reposted it with criticism of the style of yoga, of the quotation that accompanied the image, and then, of course, about the center and the teacher was sort of implied in the whole wrap-up. There are many comments on the thread supporting the stance that the critique took, and then the person in studio being critiqued posted a different image and said, did you know that Ashtanga yoga is being attacked? And then lots of people comment on their thread in support of how they do things, etc. Now, neither post were directed at one another and neither indicated as to what kind of conversation had gone on behind the scenes. And neither noted the limitations or acknowledged the experiences and the values of the other people in the image. And I think that's really important. It comes back to, what is it that those people get out of that practice? And yes, I have noted that we are all selling something. Absolutely. Both parties had a vested interest in establishing themselves as authorities because they both offer trainings and they both offer classes. It's not at all that I don't think that they shouldn't be able to have conversation and to offer analysis. Who better? They are both devoted, smart practitioner teachers. Leaders in our field should absolutely be having conversations and dialogue and analysis together. But social media creates this feeling that we know and understand one another and that we're having conversations, but the conversations are superficial. They allow for shallow engagement at best. We're living in a time where we are often looking to only speak with people who agree with us. We all know this from watching politics and watching social media algorithms play out. We are looking to reaffirm our already held beliefs. And we do this in subtle ways all the time. If you Google the wondrous gifts of the Dalai Lama, you'll find articles in support of the Dalai Lama's approaches in his politics. And if you search critiques and flaws of the Dalai Lama, you'll find them. So we tend to find what we're looking for. In these conversations, we are unaware of the fact that we are replicating some of the aspects of the guru approach that we maybe do not want to replicate, which is speaking to the people who already agree with you and only offering insights and arguments that bolster our stance and our perspective. By bringing in multiple voices, by acknowledging what other people get out of their adherence to something, we understand at least a little bit of a rounder picture. Back in particular reference to the Ashtanga system, I think, yes, we could be strictly pessimistic and say that people have money on the line, they have studios, they have incomes, all tied to Ashtanga. But if you are only loosely associated to this system, there's lots of other yoga out there for you. It's probably not that hard for you to pick up and move on. But there was a video, and if you've seen it, I would love for you to send it to me. There's a video that I watched years ago, and it was a psychologist talking about why relatives of criminals, people who have committed heinous crimes, often stay in touch with them and or believe them when they say they didn't do it. Similarly, I read an article about a woman whose father had done something really heinous and how her relationship with him after that and her feelings about his crimes, they changed, right? Progress isn't linear. Sometimes she was okay with being in contact with him, and sometimes she wasn't okay with being in contact with him. But I can't remember this particular psychologist's name, but she talked about the imperative that we have to protect the people we love and to believe them and to stay in communion with them, even if we accept that some of the things that they've done hurt other people and were immoral and wrong. Depending on someone's proximity to their teacher, to their guru, they might be really struggling to come to terms with the fact that that person did wrong things. I'm sure you could have lots of interesting conversations if you stayed open and kind in your approach with people who were adherents to Bikram Chowdhury or Sri Pattabhi Joyce's teachings. Yes, it is extra terrible that these people call themselves yogis and that they cultivated trust and that they harmed people who trusted them. But if people feel like their morality and their intellect are being critiqued and dismissed as a starting point for conversation, you're probably not going to have much of a conversation. Which brings me to the last thing, which is a reading recommendation. I'm looking at a book that I really think highly of. It was initially recommended to me by my teacher, Mona Warner, who you heard on the last episode of the podcast. And it's called Crucial Conversations, Tools for Talking When the Stakes Are High. And I know that title off by heart because I've said it so many times in practically every training that I've done. Now, it's super corporate-y. So if you are in the workforce, it's aimed toward office culture. But it's essentially conscious conversation. And I've used so many of the pragmatic tricks for it. Now, one of the pragmatic tricks for having crucial conversations is clarifying what you're not saying. And I love this one. You can guess at what someone might think is going on, and you can clarify, I am not saying that I'm saying this. I am saying that. I like this one so much that now that I'm saying it, I think I might have said it in a previous podcast. Oh well, repetition is good for memory. It also talks about the conditions for having high stakes conversations and how those conditions have to be met to have conversation. It circles back to what I was talking about at the beginning of the podcast with Krishna saying, share this with people who have at least a curiosity, but preferably an obedience to love, to people who are mutually interested in finding common ground or solutions. If you do not have people who are interested in having conversation, you can't have one. But they talk about how if enough of the conditions are met, you can have a conversation. And one of the steps in having these conversations is establishing mutual purpose. So in the yoga world, I think it's important that we say, in the interest of furthering our understanding about responsible leadership and ethical guidelines of being a teacher, I want to talk about historically what has happened, what has changed, and where we're going, or however it is you want to phrase that. But when you're engaging in yoga conversation with your peers, in your trainings, heck, on social media, establish that mutual purpose or guess at it. Once you establish your mutual purpose, we need to proceed with conversation that, and I love this because it's so yoga, we need to proceed with conversation that neither silences participation nor cultivates violence in the conversation. So direct from Crucial Conversations, page 58 in chapter 4. As people begin to feel unsafe, they start down one of two unhealthy paths. They move either to silence, withholding meaning from the pool, or to violence, trying to force meaning in the pool. Silence consists of any act to purposefully withhold information from the pool of meaning. It's almost always done as a means of avoiding potential problems, and it always restricts the flow of meaning. Methods range from playing verbal games to avoiding a person entirely. The three most common forms are masking, avoiding, and withdrawing. Violence consists of any verbal strategy that attempts to convince, control, or compel others to your point of view. It violates safety by trying to force meaning into the pool. Methods range from name-calling and monologuing to making threats. The three most common forms are controlling, labeling, and attacking. If you want to read in more detail on silencing and violence, you should pick up Crucial Conversations. But for those of you who have engaged in heated conversations, period, or in the yoga realm, you'll recognize some of these behavior patterns. And silence to avoid potential problems, to not be seen as someone who has opinions, who has some fire, who wants to further the conversation. There's so many wonderful voices out there that need to be heard. But again, if we punish people for being holistic beings rather than floating on a cloud yogis, we're not going to hear from them. We need to learn how to disagree well so that we further the conversation and that there are more diverse voices in the conversation versus our own personal little algorithm of people who already agree with us. I want to close by saying that I do believe that most of us go into this profession because we understand that many people suffer more than they need to, and that yoga offers a beautiful system of reducing suffering. That being said, if we have been hurt, we are capable of hurting. So we must proceed with loving kindness, mindfulness. We have to make sure that we are practicing. We have to make sure that we are reviewing our behavior and seeing its effects to the best of our ability, and as much as it can be difficult sometimes, soliciting feedback. That's a whole other yoga episode, though. Thank you for listening. A gentle reminder that if you're interested in spending time with me, make sure you're signed up for the newsletter at www.intelligentedge.yoga. Follow me on Instagram. Follow me on Facebook. It's all Intelligent Edge. Leave a rating and review for the podcast because it really, really helps. Enjoy all the cozy things, and I'll talk to you again soon. Namaste for now, yogis.